Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and we are a podcast that's dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. And thinking seriously, we've tried to explain what that looks like by encouraging and cultivating, hopefully, an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. So if you're a new listener to the podcast, you will find that we talk to all sorts of people about all sorts of things. I mean, there's stuff that's related to our area of interest, obviously. We're going to be talking about history and philosophy and theology and how these things sort of intersect. But we talk to people all across the theological spectrum. And we do that in part because, number one, there's always something to learn from somebody else, especially if they spent decades of their lives thinking about something that I haven't been thinking about. And there's always opportunity to learn and be curious about why other people think differently than me. It opens you up to new ways of avenues of thinking and all sorts of things like that, but it also develops your ability to critically assess other viewpoints and why they think that way and maybe why you disagree with them. So it's a lot of fun. We talk to all sorts of people. It's a great time. And in today's episode, it's going to be talking about something that's, I think, it's still very interesting to me, and I still don't think I have a full grasp on it. So we're going to be talking to Dr. Kyle Strobel, and hopefully I'll be enlightened along the way as well, talking about the nature of infusion, psychology, particularly related to Jonathan Edwards. So, you know, Edwards, when I was in high school and college, was the coolest person out there. And I don't feel like he's as cool anymore. So Kyle, just tell me a little bit about yourself, maybe what got you into Edwards and how you've gotten to where you're at now.
Yeah. Hey, Jordan. Yeah, it's good to be with you, man. And these are fun questions. My own background, so I have a background in philosophy and Bible, and I got really interested in the nature of virtue formation and particularly the conversation around spiritual formation. Through folks like Willard. I had studied philosophy with J.P. Moreland, and obviously who was mentored by Willard. And so as a seminary student, I was starting to ask questions about what is holiness? What is the nature of maturation and these sorts of things? I was interested in the question of virtue, which got me I was at Talbot School of Theology, and we have a spiritual theology department. And it was here, actually, with someone who's now become a kind of very dear mentor of mine named John Coe, who did his PhD in virtue ethics, looking at Aristotle and Thomas. And it was there, actually, that the first time I heard the distinction between acquired virtue and infused virtue. And in studying spiritual formation, I kind of realized that one of the major gaps in my own thinking was that I had not been trained to think theologically. And that if you look at the spiritual tradition, it is a distinctively theological enterprise. And so I ended up leaving the spiritual formation department to go to do my PhD in systematics at the University of Aberdeen when John Webster was there. And I actually studied under a Bonhoeffer scholar who, when I was a bit lost because I was going to do Barth and von Balthasar simply because I had never studied theology, and I was like, well, everyone's got to grapple with Barth. I might as well start with him. And I kind of got faint-hearted in the midst of that, kind of going, I don't know, man. I don't know what, you know, and von Balthasar is fascinating, but probably not the right place to start. And my supervisor asked me just at one point, he's like, have you ever interested in studying Edwards? And I laughed. I was like, Edwards? Like, what? I had never occurred to me to study Edwards. And it was really more to placate him. We still laugh about it today. I'm not sure why a Bonhoeffer scholar was like, you should study Edwards, you know, just kind of out of the blue. And his thought for me was that because I was so interested in the interplay between theology and spirituality and the question of virtue, that Edwards was just a really unique figure that was kind of enough on the cusp of the Enlightenment, where the Enlightenment hadn't really eradicated the theological enterprise of its spirituality. It hadn't kind of emptied it of that. And so he's like, Edwards is kind of the last horizon for this integration that you're looking for. It might be interesting. And I just fell in love with Edwards. At that point, as you kind of pointed out, Edwards was a little bit of a hot button kind of topic in a good way. But the funny thing was no systematicians were studying him. Hmm. I mean, I could count on one hand how many of us were doing kind of constructive theology and philosophy studying Edwards. And then it was like right after I started that suddenly this wave of scholarship that continues today kind of began in Edwards. And so that's really kind of what started me on this trajectory.
Yeah, that's interesting. Do you think the academic interest in Edwards was influenced at all by sort of the more popular reception of him?
I totally do. Yeah. I think someone like Piper and someone like Keller has probably done, even though they're not Edwards scholars, have done more for Edwards scholarship in terms of funding the interest than anyone has. I think Marsden's biography probably helped as well. Kind of that was a bit of an interesting cultural moment. And I even think the analytic theological conversation that has, you know, Edwards has become a kind of obvious place to start on some of those questions when it comes to some of his radical philosophical notions. And so you see a lot of, I think of Michael Ray, I think of Oliver Crisp, folks who turned to Edwards as just an interesting case study. I think that has helped as well.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking my own personal biography, and Edwards is one of the first real theologians that I grappled with more on like a large scale. So I think of, you know, Calvin, a lot of people cutting their teeth into his institutes, and that's giving them that sort of breadth. I took an Edwards course in my MDiv. And at the time, the job that I was working, just I had a lot of like free time on my computer. And Edwards, all of it's online. And so I just start reading like all of his different, like I'm reading his stuff on the mind, and I'm like, I have no idea what's going on. But that was like really just, it was eye-opening to see the breadth that he was able to engage. So maybe for this particular episode, we just start with a little bit of understanding his psychology, not just, you know, his own personal, like, you know, inner stuff, which I think is weird in itself.
Sometimes
I think, maybe I'm totally off, but I feel like, I don't know if I'd want to be friends with him.
That is always a debate. Yeah. Was this a cool guy to hang out with? It's like, I love Edwards, but I'd probably rather grab a beer with Luther, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
It's kind of one of those sorts of things. That's probably right. And, you know, he was a fascinating thinker. And, you know, my own interest in his psychology has recently come about in terms of, you know, I just look at our own cultural moment. I think a lot of the cutting edge issues in moral theology are all stemming from questions of personhood. They're revolving around questions of what is an integrated theological anthropology. And so I'm actually doing a large-scale study that is probably coming to a head in here in the next couple of years on Edwards's kind of theological personalism and moral psychology, and doing quite a lot of that in conversation with someone like Thomas. And so for Edwards' psychology, in many ways, it's standard. I mean, there's a very rough kind of sketch of a standard moral psychology or kind of theological psychology. You're going to have the higher rational ordering of the soul and then the lower animalistic ordering of the soul. One of Edwards' unique kind of bends to him, which is not totally unique, but is something he kind of cleans up some of these distinctions a little bit, is that in the more kind of rational ordering of the person, you have the intellect and you have the will. And again, that's going to link very closely to his psychological analogy for God as the kind of procession of the Logos and the procession of the Spirit. But then he's going to kind of ground affection in an act of the will. So affection, unlike for most Puritans actually, isn't another faculty, he would say. And Edwards does use the language of faculty, although with most of these folks, doesn't want you to think mechanism. You don't have a faculty, as it were, you intellect, you will, right? Like these are aspects of the movements of the person. And so he grounds the affection in the rational ordering of the person, but then he's going to ground passion in the animalistic nature of the person. And so one of my interests has been, I got a grant, with a sub grant with Templeton, with a series of philosophers and theologians, and I was working on the nature of emotion in Edwards. And that becomes a hard question because Edwards knows the language of emotion, although it's not the standard language yet. If Thomas Dixon is right, and I'm inclined to think he is, we ushered in emotion to kind of de-Christianize psychology and to kind of muddy the waters a bit. And I think that is exactly what it's done. For Edwards, the affections are the integration of the understanding and will towards an integrative humanity, right? These are things that are supposed to bring about a kind of holistic or a wholeheartedness, if we want to use kind of Eleanor Stump's language. Whereas the passions begin in the body and they tend to work against the soul. And so these lead to our disintegration as persons. And so the vision that Edwards gives us is the rational ordering of a person. That doesn't mean passions are bad, because affections sometimes can awaken the passions. And then when that happens, the passions can actually kind of buttress the movement of a whole person as a unified kind of integrated whole. But if you begin in the passions, they tend to work against the affect and the intellect, undoing and disintegrating the person such that the lower ends up reigning over the higher. And so that kind of vision is a pretty standard one. I mean, you're going to get all sorts of discussions about his human physiology in that. And so nature, nurture stuff, right? Like there's going to be an education and, as he would say, a prejudicing of the various faculties of the soul. Literal education will be a part of that. Family life will be a part of that. This era is going to be very interested in the motions and the fluids of the body. And so they're going to, what we would call the kind of chemical makeup of a person, maybe, they're just going to call the fluids. At the end of the day, we're just kind of saying the same thing. And so they're very aware that some persons, for instance, are melancholic. And that is going to prejudice how their intellect and will function along those lines. So that's the kind of large picture you get of Edwards. Whenever he thinks of psychology, he is also thinking of God. And so that's going to be one key difference between a kind of modern psychological understanding of the person versus kind of this era and prior, more ancient, is that his understanding of the divine rational mind is going to be paralleled in the human rational mind. And so he's never going to kind of leave that conversation off of human psychology, but it's always going to be in the backdrop.
So the first time I encountered that was I was reading Edwards. And then years later, I'm reading Augustine and his work on the Trinity. And I'm like, wait, there seems to be a parallel here in sort of how they're conceptualizing some of these analogies. Mm-hmm. Is what Edwards is doing there just more of a continuation of a long tradition of a psychological analogy for the Trinity?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Edwards is unique. I mean, my line with Edwards, and it's almost always true, is that Edwards is just doing classical things with his own idiosyncratic kind of bent. So there's always a little Edwards thrown in there. It's always an interesting cocktail in that regard, because usually he brings in some very modern and sometimes unusual and often exegetically brilliant insights. But from Augustine through Thomas to someone like Edwards, you have a psychological analogy for the doctrine of God that is going to be mirrored and paralleled in the human soul, such that for someone like Edwards, he's going to talk about God kind of emanating his life, and so communicating his life. Now, emanation here is a willed emanation, so God's not leaking. God is communicating the fullness of his life in Son and Spirit, or intellect and will, wisdom and love, we could say. The creature that can then receive that, the regenerate creature that's been illumined to receive the knowledge of God, right, to see that Jesus is in fact the image of the invisible God and to stand face to face with God himself in Christ Jesus, will then be awakened to that intellect and love, that in receiving the Spirit who is the love of God himself in the soul, the person will then begin to respond in religious affection, which is just the creaturely counterpart to the divine processions. And so you could say for Edwards that God's life is religious affection and pure act. The regenerate human person is now the religious affections according to the limited potential and actual realities of creaturely life that are now remanating, to use Edwards' words, that life back to God. And so there is emanation and there is remanation, or with someone like Thomas, there is exitus and there is reditus. But there's this movement to and from that parallels the divine processions in the human psychological kind of condition.
That's good. So we've got a little bit of a sort of like, I guess, an outline of some of the psychology that's going on here. You mentioned early on the distinction between infused and acquired virtues.
Yeah.
Maybe we sort of cash out what that distinction is. Because like you mentioned before you went to Aberdeen, I guess that was the first time you heard it from John Coe or somebody. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't know this distinction until like 2 years ago myself.
Totally. No, this has been one of the major Achilles heels in the modern philosophical discussion of virtue ethics. So the kind of retrieval of virtue ethics that has been so important in the last 50 years – has basically neglected the theological tradition. And so they've basically reduced Thomas down into a kind of Aristotle. And the belief was you can habituate goodness in your life. The Christian tradition almost universally in the West rejects that as Pelagianism. And so the distinction ends up being kind of developed that there is a way to acquire virtue. Now, just very simply, you have seeds of virtue even as an infant. You have seeds of patience. You have seeds of humility. You have these things according to nature that you can habituate and cultivate in yourself. Aristotle's phenomenal on this. And if you look at even the Reformed tradition has, according to some of David Sitzma's recent work, over 300 commentaries on the Nicomachean Ethics in its early years, because the Protestant tradition, as the broader Western tradition, recognized natural virtue is still virtue of a certain kind. Now, before God, it's filthy rags, but it's still important. And of course, with children and things, we are helping them cultivate natural virtue in their lives. There's then going to be a hard distinction drawn, though, between natural virtue and supernatural virtue. The virtue that God names virtuous is infused. And when you hear the language of infused, you can swap that out kind of with by grace alone. This is received, not something you can cultivate by nature. And so this is really, I mean, you could develop this line simply with a biblical exposition of holiness. We don't have holiness. Our call is to be holy as God is holy. The only way we can be holy is that God gives us holiness. Now, that doesn't undermine habituation, but it is going to move in a different register. And so what ends up happening in the West, pretty universally, I mean, it's going to be a major minority report to reject this, whether you're Thomas, whether you're Bernard, whether you're Scotus, whether you're Calvin or Vermigli, whether you're all the way up to Edwards, everyone is using a kind of distinction like this, whether it's explicit, infused, acquired, or whether it's just kind of implicit in how they're developing natural versus supernatural virtue. And so it's while that's standard, there's different ways to develop it. And so Edwards is going to uniquely focus on the Spirit as infused grace. And because the Spirit, according to his psychological analogy, is love and God's very love himself, what Edwards is saying is that God is infusing his love, the love the Father has to the Son, into your very person. Of course, as Romans 5:5 will say, God, the Spirit pours forth love into the heart. That is now infused in regeneration into the person. And this becomes the kind of alien feature that is now kind of a part of our human psychology that we must habituate a life according to. And that's going to be what supernatural virtue requires.
Now, I mean, help me here. I think a lot of Protestants probably hear these distinctions and they're like, is this actually what Protestants believe? That sounds a little bit Roman Catholic to at least some other debates that have gone on about what human nature is and if you need to have anything added to it in order to achieve some sort of religious state or something like that. Is there any parallel there to where Protestants are not thinking in these terms?
Well, so this is the standard Protestant line. You get it in Luther, you get it in Calvin. I mean, everyone has thought this until, you know, kind of early 19th century, probably. What ended up happening, one of the reasons why some of you might be listening to this going, wow, how on earth then have I never heard this, is that one of the things, and Edwards is an interesting example. So Edwards wrote a book that were a series of sermons on love called Charity and Its Fruits. But he kind of finalized it, but he never got a chance to publish it before he died. His great-great-great-grandson published it about 100 years after Edwards' death. And edited out every occurrence of the word infusion because it sounded too Catholic. And where Protestants have been allergic to the word infusion has been in the doctrine of justification. And so when those debates got sparked again in the early 19th century, we just ridded ourselves of the language entirely rather than remembering that, no, we actually used this in usually regeneration is where it shows up. And it was a part of a doctrine of sanctification, broadly speaking, normally, and certainly would show up in any kind of moral theology. Because if you don't have something like this, now I'm not suggesting the only way to do this is the language of infusion, or I realize there's the language has some downsides to it. It has an overly mechanized kind of feel. It has, so there's going to be some critiques along those lines. But let me suggest that if you don't have a distinction that does this work, what you will have is an account of Pelagianism. And you just simply won't be able to get around that.
Yeah, no, that's helpful. Very helpful. So when I think about the nature of infused versus acquired virtues, what are they? So like infused virtues, is there, are there always corresponding, you know, like there's a acquired courage and infused courage, or when it comes to infusion, is that just uniquely set for the theological virtues of faith, hope, and love?
Yeah. So this becomes a problem, I would say. I'm sure he wouldn't say this, but for Thomas. So, you know, Catholics are going to really have a problem here, because on their account, you do kind of get the question of, it seems like we have these two totally different systems in us. And then, of course, if you sin mortally, if you have a mortal sin, then it kind of extinguishes the infused virtues and you kind of fall back on the acquired virtues, it seems. And how does that work? And can you go back and forth? So I would say a Protestant account can avoid these and should avoid this kind of distinction. I think what has happened is, and let me use a kind of a conversion story that's later in life, let's say. So you have someone that converts when they're 18. They have acquired virtue throughout their life according to their flesh. That's not negatively per se. Some of it's actual kind of natural virtue, and there's natural vice, and there's all sorts of things in them. Upon receiving the Spirit on a kind of Edwardsian system, and again, there's a broad part of this that everyone accepts, but everyone's going to distinguish in various ways. There's not a standard way to articulate this. So that's part of the problem. But on Edward's system, you receive the Spirit. So instead of shifting off of the pneumatology to talk about something called infusion, infusion is just a description of Edward's pneumatology. So God has given you the Spirit of God who now dwells within you, but he's now going to articulate, well, what does that even mean? Yes, it means you have the personal presence of God, but he's going to say you have the Spirit who in the inner life of God, according to Scripture, functions psychologically within the inner life of God and now functions in you as now a disposition of the soul. So now you have a disposition of love that has been ingrained in your soul. And I think you could find it, actually. So if you're a brand new believer, there is something called there's something we can just name as yes that is now in your soul that wasn't before conversion. Right? So you might have been listening to a preacher talk before you were converted, and there was this guy's an idiot in my soul somewhere. Like, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. Whatever. I'm not a sinner. Sin doesn't matter. Now you're sitting there and there's this yes in you. And Edwards would say, yeah, there's this new disposition that has been infused into your soul. You now have a character, though, of courage, of humility, of patience. And you now have to be recharacterized. And you need a new foundation, which is going to be the love of God poured in the soul. And you need to have a new telos to that virtue, which isn't virtue itself. It isn't even your formation, but it's God now that is now ingrained in you. So by providing a new foundation and a new telos, it kind of brings a kind of judgment of your fleshly virtue as that. This is just fleshly. Like, these are filthy rags. It doesn't mean they're evil. It means they're, like, before the face of God, my natural courage doesn't bring me anywhere. And all of these virtues now need to be transformed according to the infusion of love that is in my soul. And so Edwards is going to say, and again, there's different ways to articulate this, but I think everyone wants to say something like this in the theological tradition, that love stands uniquely among the virtues. And for Edwards, there is one virtue, and it's love. And the way love characterizes a person shows up through all of our virtues. So what is patience but love kind of integrated into the whole of the person? What is humility but love integrated? So as a person is characterized by love, the fruit of the spirit of love begins to be manifested in and through their life. And so we still need to habituate, but now we're habituating from a kind of new center. It is by grace, it is receptive first and foremost, but a new telos is ingrained into our habituation as well, where we are now, to use kind of Paul's claim in Romans 12, we are now presenting our bodies as living sacrifices, where God is the kind of the telos of that. And now my habituation is to offer myself to God, who has given me the very things I'm giving back to him.
Now, does this relate at all to the idea of Edwards potentially having like a sixth sense with regeneration? Is there a sense in which this infusion of these virtues or of love, is that a restoration of something that's broken, or is that that's a completely new thing that's truly alien and foreign? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. No, so for Edwards, just like for Thomas, we are, in receiving the Spirit, we're actually receiving something that is supernatural that was ingrained in nature with us. So it is supernatural, but we were created supernaturally as nature. This is the problem with this language, is that in nature. So Edwards will literally say that in the fall, what happened is the Spirit of holiness, which is the only possible way for a creature to be holy, is kind of removed, and humankind now falls in upon themselves. And so we are recovering something. Now, we're not recovering it in the same way as in creation, because now we're receiving the Spirit of Christ, and that there's going to be a unique developmental bent to that in kind of redemption history. But we are receiving the very thing that we were created to be, that is reestablishing our humanity, not undermining our humanity.
Okay, that's helpful. So when I think about infused virtues, how do we come to possess these? I mean, is this a completely passive process? So like I think of regeneration, particularly in the Reformed tradition, where that's more of just, that's a passive act upon me on which like I'm not actively seeking it out or something. You know, the Lord is doing something to me. But is that true as we grow in these infused virtues? Does that remain the same where I'm just a passive recipient of these things?
I mean, in one sense, I would say that's a little closer to Thomas than it is to the Reformed. I mean, Thomas is going to be very clear about this. You know, he'll say that an infusion cannot be caused by human acts, but is produced in us by the divine operation alone. That's Thomas. What's interesting is when you get to someone like Edwards on regeneration, he's going to say, God does all and we do all. And part of this, and it's funny because Thomas has a line where when he talks about, so part of the confusion on Thomas, I think, among philosophers has been, when you read in the Summa Theologiae, the Prima Secunda, if you read just the first, I don't know, 54 questions, yeah, he's going to sound a whole lot like Aristotle because he's doing something kind of just natural virtue there. When you get to question 55, though, he's going to start shifting his attention to infused virtue. And he's going to say there, he says, God is the efficient cause of infused virtue to which this definition applies, his definition kind of virtue in general. And he says, but this is expressed in the words which God works in us without us. And so Thomas actually emphasizes the without us part. And it's funny, when John Owen gets here, he actually says the exact opposite. He says, God doesn't work in us without us. But what's interesting is it is a kind of movement of God as the efficient cause. But because God is not set against his creature, it awakens our will. And we are, this is why Edwards says God does all and we do all, because God's act actually produces free willing in us. And so in infusion, and usually in particularly later Reformed accounts of regeneration, you'll have union, illumination, and infusion. And so illumination is kind of opening our eyes to see the reality of God. Infusion is to infuse the divine love into the heart. That's all receptive, but that immediately awakens our faculties. And when you were commenting on Edwards' kind of sixth sense kind of idea, it's Edwards, what he's talking about there is he likes the language of taste. You've actually kind of tasted now the truth. You have seen beauty, and you can recognize it as beautiful. And so that has an integrating dynamic to the human person, where suddenly you're awoke to the fact that this is beauty, this is truth. And what that then does is it orders the understanding and the will around God. But then we have to still develop this, because that remains as a disposition in us, that kind of yes in the soul. But remember, all of your capacities already have a character to them. Your humility has a character to it. Your courage has a character to it. And it's been trained in the flesh and for the flesh. Now you have to be recharacterized, or to use the language that a lot of our own tradition liked to use, you have to be weaned off of the flesh onto the spirit. And that means there's going to have to be a developmental maturation of a person that requires a new dependence and reliance upon the things of God, and that is ordered to the things of God. And so that's why I don't want to undermine the focus on habituation, but I think we have to have an entirely different account between natural and supernatural habituations. I just think it's a different sort of thing. And I would say one of the key elements is, you know, you're in a Pelagian account if you can remove God from the equation and it doesn't do anything to the equation. Whereas what Augustine is clear on in his anti-Pelagian writings, particularly as he rests on the passage, which is going to be Philippians 2, 12 and 13, is that, yes, we do need to work out our salvation with fear and trembling, but it's precisely because God works in us both to will and to work. And so it's a habituation that is based upon God's action in us that requires God's personal presence to us to be kind of effective. And so that's going to change how we think about the nature of habituation.
Okay. So one thing that made me think of is Augustine versus Thomas in their accounts of virtue. It almost seems like there is a distinction in which Augustine kind of wants to say, like, all acquired virtues are hypocritical.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So is there a way we can sort of like meld these two things together, or is one approach better than the other?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I this is an area where I think Augustine just didn't find the proper resources. It is true that before the face of God, we can say natural virtue is vice. But it is also true that we have to be able to give an account of pagan virtue as virtue. I think that's what Thomas, and this is what the Protestant tradition recognized, that, yeah, we can talk about how the flesh acts apart from God in a certain sense, but we have to be able to talk about the difference between a bad pagan and a good pagan. We have to be able to kind of laud virtue formation in the created order where we see it, and we have to be able to name that as virtue. And so I think some of the problem becomes there. Augustine struggles with the nature of ends at times, and it gets a bit reductive. Whereas we need to be able to talk about the kind of proper ends of our humanity, and the kind of true and perfect end of our humanity as different kind of registers within to talk about virtue, such that there's actually goods in the secular realm that are actually good, even though before the face of God. So you were always having to bring in the question of before the face of God, these aren't kind of perfections, as it were. Nonetheless, they're goods. And so I do think the outside of Augustine, almost everyone I've seen, and again, this is particularly true of the Protestant tradition, wants to be able to say, we have to talk about goods in the natural order. And if we can't, that's on us in a very real sense.
So another question that I have is, if I have both an infused and acquired virtue of the same kind, is it really possible that I would be acting from one and not the other? So I guess if it is, how do I ensure that I'm acting from infused courage or rather than acquired courage, et cetera?
Yeah. Yeah, I want to avoid that kind of construct. So I don't want to say you have infused courage and I think you just have courage. And you have a courage that has been characterized in the flesh and in the spirit in various ways.
Yeah.
And so I think you need to come to see. This is where my own view, you know, I teach in a department of spiritual theology. You know, my own view is going to be, let's shift away from some of the standard language into more maturation language. Like a lot of us, particularly use my early example of the kind of 18-year-old who becomes a Christian, they're now infused with love and goodness and joy. And they're like, they were in the spirit, they receive something that is not a mirror of their character, but is actually antithetical to their character and is given by the grace of God. What that person's going to have to see in maturation is they actually are quite immature in their humility, in their courage, in their love, and it's going to be in recognizing the immaturity of their character that they're going to have to rediscover both grace as well as God as the only possible solution to the malformation of their character. And so what this means is that one of the great Christian temptations, which is what we've always known, is that you will be tempted not to habituate yourself supernaturally. You will be tempted to replace Christ with Aristotle. And I would actually argue this is precisely what's gone on today, that the bulk of works I've read on virtue formation have simply been Pelagian, that this is the same problem Paul sees in Galatia, that they started with the spirit but tried to advance themselves in the flesh. It's the same problem in Colossae, where they, instead of, you know, what is the temptation to philosophy in Colossians 2? It's the temptation to self-made religion based on asceticism of the body that has the appearance of wisdom but has let go of Christ. And I think we have neglected over the last 50 years how tempting it is to replace supernatural virtue formation with its natural counterpart. And I think what ends up happening isn't that you have these two systems up and running, but that we end up having really immature Christians who think the answer is cultivating natural virtue, which unfortunately just leads to vices, like I would say supernatural vices, like, because natural virtue never leads you into humility as it's properly understood. And I'm thinking here of someone like Kent Dennington's work on humility, mm-hmm. where you have a displacement of the self that occurs. You know, the supernatural virtue alone is what leads you to say Galatians 2:20, it is no longer I who live, but Christ, right? Like that's different than its kind of impotent natural counterpart of just don't boast about yourself too much. But if we embrace natural virtue, this is the kind of virtue that puffs up and that centers the self rather than loses our life to find it in Christ. And so there's going to be new virtues that emerge according to infusion. But by and large, I think it's going to be a maturation that happens of the capacities we have of things like courage, humility, that always remain a singular capacity rather than these two different systems up and running.
Yeah, no, that's helpful. And I guess part of the challenge, like you've been using more biblical language, is I think a lot of people might come to this conversation and be like, you know, I'm reading my Bible and like, I just don't see how these things map on there appropriately because mm-hmm. they're just different terms in total. So if you were to, let's say you're talking to a college student, mm-hmm. I mean, is your entryway into this discussion explaining it to them? Let's walk through some epistle or Pauline text or something like that and sort of like explain the framework that's going on there and then sort of lay it on this? Or what's like the entryway for it?
Yeah, that's right. That is what I would do. And I would probably probably initially start with just pneumatology. No one has a problem talking about the indwelling of the Spirit. But good luck finding an account of it, right? I mean, if we're talking about college, like, well, what is the Spirit doing in the soul, and how do we think of, or you know, take Ephesians 3, what does it mean that the Spirit is working with power in your inner being, so that Christ might dwell in your heart by faith, so that you may know the unknowable love of God, right? So it's like it's about knowing love, it's about Christ's dwelling in you, well. And then if you get to Colossians 2, you get to Galatians 3. Like, there's these passages that are going to show, well, we need to bear the fruit of the Spirit. What's going on there? Like, I think the infusion conversation is simply articulating the difference between advancing a life in the Spirit and walking in the Spirit, rather than walking merely according to the flesh, using flesh there as just kind of not necessarily negative, but from the self and for the self. And so that's how I would differentiate those things. I think holiness is an obvious place to turn to for this that oddly the tradition hasn't. Like, what does it mean to be holy as God is holy? And, well, yeah, I mean, we're going to have to I think no matter how you articulate that, you're going to end up with an account that sounds an awful lot like infusion. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's ways to get at it that doesn't fall victim to maybe the overly abstract language of infusion. Again, that's always been the Achilles heel, I think, of the distinction is, like a lot of scholastic distinctions, it sounds mechanistic, it sounds depersonalizing, you know, and I think that only comes from not really attending to what the language is about. But I also get that on a kind of, you know, I'm the current elder chair of an elder pastor church. So I get these questions. And I think there's plenty of very easily biblical work you can do to show all of this and then say, oh, by the way, the tradition always talked about this. We called it infusion.
Yeah. No, that's helpful. So if let's say someone wants to get a grip or grasp on this topic in general, are there any good introductory texts out there today that you would generally recommend?
No. And that is the problem. I mean, there are no texts on this in terms of secondary literature. So I am currently at the tail end of editing a volume with a dear friend of mine, Lucy Pepiet, and with Routledge, that is going to map the Christian tradition on this. So we're focused on Protestantism, actually, because Catholics are well aware of their own tradition on this. But we include Bernard, Scotus, and Thomas in an intro section because that's obviously the people that the Protestants are reading. And then starting with Luther, we go up through kind of Bart, and then we have some constructive essays at the end. And so our hope is to provide that text because there's nothing out there. The best starting point is, and the only book I know of that is explicitly on this topic at all, actually, interestingly enough, that focuses solely on this is Angela Noble's book on infused moral virtues in Thomas Aquinas, which is an edited version of her dissertation. Very well written, profoundly clear. Angela's doing great work on this. She's actually writing the chapter on Thomas for us. She's obviously thinking she's a Catholic. She's thinking about it as a Catholic. She doesn't realize how similar Catholics and Protestants are on this issue. So, you know, by and large, when I read Protestants, they're saying the exact same thing. You know, grace perfects nature. They're reading Thomas on all of this. John Owen is explicitly reading Thomas. So there has been some work on John Owen where I've never seen a work that focuses solely on this in John Owen. But like Christopher Cleveland wrote a book on Owen's reception of Thomas that includes a couple chapters on it. So you'll get things like that in there. But the secondary literature is sadly thin on this topic. There are articles and things. But if you really want to get into at least the Thomistic strand of this, and that's a book that's currently in print, Angela Noble's book is the way to do it. And then, I keep a lookout for our book. I think it's going to be – my hope is it'll be – not only a helpful introduction to the topic, but it's going to introduce kind of Protestants to our own tradition. And because this is something we have totally lost.
That's awesome. I'm very excited about that. So thanks for sharing about that. Now, if people want to like read more of your stuff, remind me, do you have a website? I think you do.
I do. I mean, the best place to find me is just kylestrobel.substack.com. Okay. That is where I'm doing a lot of things. I have an Edwards podcast on there called 10 Minute Edwards, which I'm kind of having some fun with. That's going to be like a mini course across Edwards theology. But that's certainly where I find, if you're interested in kind of updates on the work I'm doing in general, I usually post those there. I have also written, and I could send you links to these, but I have, if you are interested in someone more like Edwards and infusion, I have focused on infusion and humility, I was going to say humility, although that's not right, infusion and gratitude, because there's been a lot of psychological interest in gratitude. And I wanted to point out, this is great. Gratitude's awesome. All you're talking about is natural gratitude. And even when a psychologist talks about gratitude of God, it's natural gratitude. And that is going to function differently than gratitude that is funded by infusion. And so I do have an article published on that where I kind of engage the current discussion of gratitude and by using infusion. So that's kind of an interesting case study. If you're interested in some how infusion might work in a reformed context, that would give you that kind of background as well.
Yeah. So last question, somewhat related, somewhat not. Is Edwards a panentheist?
So, you know, that is a great question, actually. So Oliver Crisp and I wrote an introduction to Jonathan Edwards together with Erdmans. And I kind of let Oliver focus on the philosophy of Edwards, and I did all the theology of Edwards. Oliver thinks he is. I think you can give a coherent account of Edwards where he's the right sort of panentheist. And by that, I mean he has a creator-creature distinction in place and protected. I think there's another way you could read Edwards where he's entirely classical, but he's just pushing really hard on certain sorts of things. So I think Edwards probably, I mean, again, I don't think it's wrong to think in that category with Edwards, as long as you remember he's got the right mechanisms in place to protect against the error. If you're looking to critique error, Edwards, there's better places to go after him when it comes to the doctrine of God and creation. And that is his doctrine of continuous creation, mm-hmm. which is a dumpster fire. and so I actually, so in Oliver's and I's book, The Introduction to Edwards, I wrote the last chapter called Becoming Edwardsian, where I argue that if you're going to be faithful to Edwards, you have to reject him on several key things, and including some of this stuff. And I do think the right way to read Edwards, I think a lot of people read him as a radical philosopher. That isn't true. Edwards is an entirely traditional theologian who thinks the only way to say traditional things after Newton is to say radical philosophical things, because he just didn't know the classical tradition on this stuff. Like he doesn't have Thomas sitting in front of him. He doesn't have access to this stuff. And so Edwards is a determinist who doesn't want to be. He's a determinist because he's trying to create space for creaturely freedom when you have a mechanized universe as a reformed person. And so God has to become the mechanism, because if you're going to err on God is all or God is nothing, you're going to err on God is all. And so I think Edwards is actually cultivating space for creaturely freedom and action, even though he ultimately undermines it, not because he wants to, but because he doesn't have the resources to think otherwise. I mean, he's on the cusp of this stuff and he's just trying to kind of salvage something. So I actually have a very different read, even though I think people are right about what Edwards is saying. I have a different read on why Edwards is saying the things he is. And it's not because I think he wants to say these things. I think he feels like he has to save them to try to kind of maintain a traditional Christian view.
That's fascinating. You know, how does he, I mean, I know this is totally off topic, but I'm just thinking, like, how does he not have access to some of these resources? I understand different periods, you know, there's not a lot of books around, but I'm like, how has he not at least had some access to somebody like Thomas?
I mean, there's a couple reasons. I mean, he's on the wilderness front. Like his house is being fortified with soldiers because of the Native Americans doing raids through. I mean, this is there's no libraries around close. He's not at Yale anymore. I mean, he spent some time there, but he's not, and even Yale wasn't like Yale had a great library at this point. But you're also on the cusp of the Enlightenment when what was old wasn't interesting. It's what is new is interesting. And so the books you're going to be interested in are going to be, what is Malebranche up to? What did Locke kind of just do? What is Newton saying in his Optics? They don't have the resources in general, because there wasn't the emphasis put on the recovery. I mean, I think we can sometimes forget, if you just look at some of the sources we use regularly, I mean, most of them are sitting behind me right now. Like, there's a reason all these are in modern editions. Like, they weren't even being published back then, a lot of them. I mean, the only piece of Augustine Edwards read was the Confessions, if he read it at all. And so it's amazing to think how, even compared to 100 years before, I mean, John Owen had a great library, but he's also in Britain. he's in a very elite class of people. And Edwards isn't. I mean, this is, you know, he's in this kind of podunk town. He's in, you know, it's a very different world that Edwards is living in. So he's getting Thomas through Owen and Tretton and von Maastricht and folks that read them directly. But it's pretty far removed. And it's not like Edwards had all of Owen's works available to him, even that. I mean, so it's pretty amazing. What's funny about Edwards was he ends up sounding a lot like a church father in a lot of ways because of the Cambridge Platonists. And so you have a weird kind of moment philosophically where Edwards is taking the Bible and infusing it with a kind of Platonic synthesis on his own, but is doing so post Locke and Newton. So that gives this weird kind of tinge to his thinking. And it's funny how many times he ends up saying things that sound exactly like someone like Basil or Gregory of Nyssa without any access to their thought. I mean, that's what's fascinating to me as an Edwards scholar reading this stuff, going, wow, it is truly amazing what he achieved given how little he had.
Yeah, that truly is amazing. Well, maybe we'll have to talk about Edwards just sometime in the future.
That'd be fun.
But thanks, Carl. This has been great. I've really enjoyed this, and I thank you for I tell people all the time who are listening, like, you need to support people who are doing this work that's making things accessible. So we just talked about a topic where we don't even have an introductory text. So when you see Kyle's work, just go buy it and support him in those sort of things. Now, if you publish with Oxford, then that's your fault. So that nobody can afford it. But Routledge, I mean, for example, so you got to know how some of these things work. So Routledge, they almost all the time come out with that hardcover book that's like $180 or whatever.
That's
stupid.
Right.
But then a year later, they have the paperback version that's reasonable that you can actually go purchase. So just like, you understand how that works. And then always, I remind you, you have libraries, local libraries and theological libraries and everything. You can ask them to buy books. They have budgets for these sort of things, and then they will go purchase it. And not only do you get to benefit, but your local friends and families can then go benefit from it. Because I know there are families who need to be buying or to be reading these books too. So make sure your library gets a copy of it, whatever it is. So support people like Kyle and what he's doing. It's really, really important work, and we're thankful for it. So thanks for tuning in to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet, and we'll talk to you all soon.
At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger. And future stronger you can get started now by saving $28 or more when you join today. You in? We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need to keep stepping it up. And free fitness training to help you mix up your routine. Plus, most clubs are open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more. Just $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends February 28th. See Home Club for details.